Yeah, so I'm a dark matter experimentalist. I'm looking for kind of dark matter in the Wundt regime. And there's kind of two ways. I don't think I need to convince anyone here that dark matter exists or that why we might care about looking for it. But I will just, by way of introduction, start talking about kind of where the search for dark matter is and kind of how we're trying to push it forward. So in addition to kind of looking for the axion-like particles that exist and I know very little about, the way to progress in looking for kind of dark matter in the classical Wundt range is twofold. One of the ways you can do this is basically look in the same mass range that people have looked for the last 30 years, but probe it at lower cross-sections. To do this, we have the technology. It's a big xenon-based experiment, and they're really, really good at what they do, but they're only pretty good at that. Fundamentally, this is just a question of building bigger ones that are more expensive, that take more people. It's a question of money and time. The other way that is what I'll be talking about mostly today is looking at lighter masses. So there are kind of fundamental cutoffs in the masses that these xenon-based experiments can probe, and we're looking to push beyond that. And the way we do this is by building calorimeters with really good energy resolution, looking for dark matter scattering off nuclei that are much lighter than the xenon that xenon experiments, of course, use. So just to schematically kind of show the way our approach works, we're a calorimeter, as I said, and it's based on a crystal. Kind of silicon is the baseline thing you can think of here, but we're interested in using other crystals like sapphire with the oxygen nuclei that's, of course, lighter than silicon, or maybe diamond or something like that. The idea is you've got some kind of dark matter particle that comes in, hits one of the nuclei inside your detector, and it transfers momentum to it. Eventually, this turns into athermal phonons that are kind of bouncing around inside your calorimeter. And because we're doing these experiments at very low temperatures, at about 10 millikelvin, the aluminum films we have on the surface of the detector are superconductors. Now, what happens when you have an athermal phonon that goes inside one of these superconductors is it breaks the Cooper pairs responsible for superconductivity and creates this excited state called a quasiparticle that kind of diffuses around inside your superconductor. Those we get to diffuse down to this piece of tungsten that we call a TES, a transition edge sensor. So this is a superconductor that we've held right between it switching from being a superconductor at zero resistance to a normal metal at finite resistance. And you can imagine that if we engineer the material such that this is a steep transition, that we can make it into a really sensitive calorimeter. Basically, if we add just a little bit of energy, it warms up a little bit, but the resistance changes by a lot. And it's effectively this resistance that we measure. So just to kind of go through the process once more, dark matter hits the detector, makes phonons, the phonons come into the fins, make quasiparticles, and then those heat up the TES, and we measure the heating in this TES. So this is in some ways a very exciting and potentially successful approach, and people were excited about doing this. The only problem is the new friends we met are along the way, specifically the low energy excess. So CREST is the group that's basically trying to do exactly what we're trying to do, and they're a little bit ahead of the curve. And in 2017, they started working in this direction. And they found something super surprising, which is at the lowest energies that they measured, which is where they need to have the best performance of their detector to search for light dark matter, they saw that they had a background of events that kind of rose as energy fell and was completely unexpected. This isn't some traditional background. This isn't like something in the lead-210 chain that's just really weird. It's not some, you know, gamma ray interacting in some unexpected way with your silicon, for example. And interestingly, it's not instrumental noise. This is really what I thought when I first saw this plot. I thought, they've just, you know, got some weird noise event that they don't understand correctly. But if you look at the events that make up this kind of rising spectrum, they look exactly like you'd expect from a particle hitting your detector and making phonons. So they're not the only game in town. There's other experiments in addition to us looking to do the same thing. And quickly, these competing experiments saw the similar thing. They saw an exponentially rising background as energy fell. And they started to notice other interesting things. One of these first things is that it didn't seem to matter whether you were deep underground like CREST or just a little bit underground or at the surface. You saw this background no matter what. The other interesting thing that was seen is that if you count up the number of events in this background, it varies as a function of time. And it doesn't just go down with time. It turns out it seems to depend in some complicated way on the temperature of your fridge, or rather the temperature history of your fridge. So if you were to warm up your detector, you can kind of temporarily enhance this rate. And then it seems to decay away slowly over time. One of these experiments, called Edelweiss, in addition to being able to measure the phonons created in these events, could measure the charge associated with these events. So if there's ionization associated with this. And this is what you'd expect if you had something like a gamma ray or a neutron hitting your detector. In addition to making a bunch of phonons, it's going to transfer some energy to the electronic system and ionize some electrons, which could then be picked up. But this wasn't what they saw. They saw that there were no electrons, no ionization, as far as they can measure, associated with this event. So these couple pieces of evidence seem to indicate that, again, our initial impression that this isn't something, you know, radiogenic or some traditional background, that it's not this. Also, it really doesn't seem to be dark matter, as exciting as that might be. I don't know of a way to make dark matter coupled to the temperature history of your fridge, and I haven't heard a convincing explanation. But aside from that, it really does look like real events. This isn't something that you can just look at a funky pulse shape and say, this is a background. Let's look for dark matter with these other characteristics. So there's other experiments that are purely ionization-based, and they see an excess too. So in these types of detectors, there's both kind of calorimetry-based ionization ones and CCD-based ones. What they do is effectively count ionized electrons in their experiment. And they expect a certain number of single electron events. But what was unexpected is they see way more multi-electron events than they naively expect as well. And this was quickly lumped in with the calorimetry results to be called a low energy excess. Basically, all these light dark matter direct detection experiments see extra energy that kind of rises in this characteristic way as energy decreases at the very lowest energies they can see. Yeah?
Edelweiss didn't see any ionization signals.
I'm being a little fast and loose here. Associated, especially with the time variation, they didn't see, basically if they separated their population into the ones that varied in time and the ones that didn't, the ones that varied with time didn't have this background. I think Daniel would argue that there should be some subpopulation in the Edelweiss results that do result in some ionization as well. Maybe just to say it a different way, there's a very large population of phonon events without this extra ionization, and that's surprising.
What is the time scale for like this?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So this is, in this plot, we're looking at hundreds of days. This is actually multiple different runs, and this is, again, hundreds of days. So it's pretty slow. But what you'll also notice is that, I don't know, at least to me, maybe it's multi-component in some way, but there's no like single time constant scale. That's one of the challenging aspects of it. There's also some CREST results that I haven't shown in the slide that just came out. And they similarly don't seem to see at least just one component to that fall off at time. So what Daniel and his collaborators discovered, they really made the first kind of leap forward towards understanding this stuff. And their realization was that the detector wasn't the only important part of the system, that detectors, of course, are surrounded by lots of different stuff that we use to hold them and read them out and part of the cryogenic system. And it turns out that if you have high-energy particles that interact with these kind of non-detector-specific materials, they'll deposit a lot of energy in these other materials. But critically, a small amount of it can get back to the detector in the form of optical photons. And that this can, in fact, produce kind of small amounts of energy deposited in your detector from these much larger and better understood backgrounds, such as muons or electrons or whatnot. And given this information that part of this background, at least, seems to be due to the scintillation and light emission from these materials like PCBs that surround detectors, us experimentalists, such as Valentino Nevadi at Northwestern, have kind of gone through a systematic effort of trying to get rid of all these materials around the detector. And in many ways, they've been very successful. So this is, you'll remember this figure. And what you should be looking at is kind of the presence of these individual peaks associated with individual electron events. And kind of as the technology progresses and more materials are removed, you'll see that these kind of single peak-like things fall away. What you're left with is, this is also a phonon-based measurement in some ways, what you're left with is kind of this phonon excess that calorimetry experiments have seen as well. So what I'm proposing is that stress backgrounds are responsible for this. And this is kind of a new thing. It's not like a neutron interacting or scattering off somewhere in your experiment. It's not a gamma. It's nothing like that. So before I tell you in detail how I think this might work, I'll just give you a little bit of a picture to hold in your head while I'm trying to explain how we are beginning to understand this stuff. So the basic idea is you've got a detector, and it's in some kind of mechanically excited state. So just like a string, it gets stretched somehow, maybe by thermal contraction, maybe just by the the energy of holding it, or somehow baked into the detector. And this at least partially relaxes somehow. I've kind of schematically shown this as a little fracture or lightning bolt happening, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a fracture like you'd see, I don't know, in the ground during an earthquake. And somehow this relaxation process releases phonons, and that's what we see in our detector. So really the prehistory of this predates this low energy excess that first started cropping up in the late 2010s. It goes all the way back to CREST, again, a dark matter direct detection experiment, who started seeing events like this around 2005. So now what they saw was, at the time, their detector performance was way, way worse. They were looking at way higher energies. But at these energies, at tens and hundreds of keV, they still saw this. They saw what was a characteristic rising with falling energy, kind of somewhat exponential-like thing. And through a bit of troubleshooting, they figured out that they had clamps that were tightening very tightly into their detector and were concentrating stress at really small points in their detector. And what was happening is they were actually getting cracking on the surface of the detector. So this is an electron microscope photograph, the small surface of the portion of the detector. And you can see there are these cracks propagating outward from this individual point where one of their clamps was contacting. And once they got rid of these clamps, basically this background went away and they declared success. But since then, it's been a little bit forgotten until my advisor, when these results first started coming out, Matt Pyle, started remembering back to this CREST result, thinking, huh, this really could be connected. So not only is the spectral shape really similar, albeit at about 1,000 times lower energy, but it kind of naturally explains a couple things. One is the time variation since cooldown, since you stress the stuff and then it kind of relaxes over time, and probably the thermal history can stretch or shrink the stuff to re-stress it. It also explains why it's zero yield. If you're having hundreds or thousands of atoms rearranging, and you get hundreds, let's just say, of EV, actually the energy per atom that rearranges is pretty small. It's well less than an EV. And you wouldn't necessarily expect that there's enough energy there to ionize charge, which would explain why we don't see ionized charges. What this also implies is that there's a good way to move forward from here, and that's just by eliminating stress kind of everywhere you can, specifically starting with the way you hold your detectors. And it's kind of, there's a lot of ways in which you can stress your detectors. So there's the CREST way of having clamps that have a really small contact area that concentrates it at a small point. Other detectors like CPD, you actually flex them when you put them in the clamps. So that's clearly bad. And then there's other techniques involved with gluing detectors down, where contraction between the glue and the silicon, say, could result in stress in the system as well.
Why won't this stress relax over time? I mean, if things contract,
So we're proposing that through the relaxation of this stress, that's where the energy is coming from. Basically, we have an energy reservoir from this stress state, and that's getting slowly transferred into our phonon system.
Is that energetically consistent? So if you compute the amount of elastic energy in your hall detector, and then you're saying, okay, it's being released into phonons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I thought that the amount of energy being released into phonons is too small for the whole reservoir.
Well, I'd say it a different way. I'd say there's plenty of energy to go into the phonon system.
Which is the stress wouldn't relax, right? Because there's so much energy available that.
So I think depending on the exact situation, so whether it's glue or, as I'll talk about later, the metal, it's a question of efficiency. You know, presumably this isn't 100% efficient process, so you really have a question of what fraction of the energy associated with one relaxation event. Just to more explicitly talk about what we're asking about, you can imagine that if you integrated up all the energy associated with this tail and made some, you know, expectation about what it's going to do in the future, and then you look at the characteristic energy of each event, that tells you a total energy, and then, of course, you know how to calculate the energy in a spring, so you can calculate the energy stored in stress in kind of one scenario. Mm-hmm.
Like, how much of like this stress come from like the process, or like just when you?
So it depends on the situation. For it's easiest to think about from the cooling process, because that kind of it's easy to look up thermal contractions at a table, and it naturally just gives you the same thing every single time. You can have both, though. Like, of course, if you tighten the clamp into a detector at a room temperature, it might get tighter while cold, but the initial stress is still important. I think usually we think that the thermal contraction is most important, and maybe it's just because it's most difficult to eliminate. Okay, so from this kind of hypothesis that stress is responsible, what we wanted to do is try to make, lower stress detectors to try to bear out, hey, could this be creating some kind of low energy background that we don't understand? And the first idea for how to do this that we came up with is what we called a resting concept. So it's literally you take a silicon detector, actually it's much smaller, you take a silicon detector, you just put it down in a piece of copper and it just sits there. And the only force in it is mg, there's no clamps, there's no glue, there's no nothing. Now the problem with this is since we want to do our experiments at really low temperatures, you need to cool this thing down, and normally the way this is done is by, hard mechanical force between things. But what instead we did is connected a gold wire bond from our fridge that's made out of copper and stuff that sticks to gold to the surface of our detector. And basically, it lets thermalized phonons travel down this gold wire through electron-phonon coupling into our fridge. So we can get them cold. Great. The other problem is that when we run our fridge, it actually vibrates. I can talk more about why that's the case if people are interested. But the issue is it vibrates with about, a 10,000th of a G or something like that. It turns out, though, that when you're a super-sensitive dark matter detector, that you can feel this force through the sliding around on the surface. And this creates not only noise, but actually events that would kind of completely overwhelm us. However, what you can do is, just to kind of prove out this technique for really short intervals, you can turn your fridge off, and everything stays cold enough to, for about 15 minutes, run your experiment, look for your background, and see if there's anything interesting going on. And that is what's seen. So this is comparing a detector that's glued down with one resting on the surface. And there's a lot going on in this plot, but I'll just draw your eye to in the lower left corner, we're at lowest energies, and you'll see that there's a big population of events in the glue detector that aren't present in the resting detector. So this is at least like a tantalizing result, right? We've reduced the stress in our holding. Some events have gone away. Great. To do longer dark matter searches, though, what we really want to do is not just run for 15 minutes, be able to run for a day or a week or much longer than that. So this is a technology we developed called hanging, very creatively named, in which we take a detector, and rather than just sitting on a surface, we connect what are called aluminum wire bonds, basically pieces of aluminum about the size of a human hair. We just kind of effectively smush them onto the surface of the detector and hold it by it. So this is a centimeter square detector we're looking at. And then at this corner, and in the middle back here, you can see the sets of wire bonds holding it up. This is our thermal bond, and these are electrical ones. And what we found is that not only is this kind of a low stress state and potentially pretty interesting to look at, this vibration problem goes away. And these Noyon plots you can see on the right here, you can see resting experiences a lot of degradation at low frequencies, and hanging doesn't. Okay, great. So what we really wanted to do with this stuff is compare the low stress state and the high stress states and see if this makes something that looks like the low energy excess. To do this, we took two detectors that were absolutely as identical as possible. They're the same design of these little dots, the phono detectors on the surface. They're made on the same wafer at the same time. They're held in the same detector cavity. They're literally less than a centimeter apart from each other. We're just trying to get as rid of as many variables as possible so we can really boil stuff down to, does the way we hold these things make a difference? And it turns out that it does. So this is comparing the high stress detector, that's the glued down one, and the low stress detector. And the first thing that I hope jumps out at you as it jumped out at us is that at the very lowest energies that there's a huge difference in the number of events. This is about a factor of 200 times difference in the number of events we saw at the lowest energies. And not only do we see more events here, but they behave spectrally just like the low energy excess. You've got this falling off background with respect to time, with respect to energy, great, we've made something that spectrally at least looks like a low energy excess. Before I move on, let me explain something that's also probably jumping out to you, which is out here, there's clearly a difference in the performance of these two things. So when I said we tried to make them as similar as possible, we didn't totally succeed. It turns out they saturate in energy at a slightly different range. So you can imagine that you kind of map this type of structure onto this type. They're very similar shape. I'll also tell you that there's the same number of events in both the red curve and the blue curve in that region, which is what you'd expect. You expect the same number of high energy events from muons and gammas and stuff like that in your detector. That all makes sense.
Switch the two?
Actually, we could probably. We didn't consider that. So these hanging things are actually kind of single use, it turns out. Like once you connect this stuff to the surface, you break them off, you can't connect a second set, but actually you probably could switch them. I hadn't thought about that. That's an interesting idea.
Electron volts, the size, if you have a crack on the Lewis thing, it has a maximum crack length.
Yeah, I guess so.
Is that 40 electron volts?
I never thought of that. I guess the picture I have in my head is that the crack, rather than going like through the glue vertically, is going along the surface. I mean, the glue itself is probably, 100 microns thick, something like that. My guess is that's probably larger than this ADEV energy scale. But again, you have to make some kind of assumptions about how efficiently you get the energy from the glue into your detector, into the TES. Sorry, did someone else ask something? The other thing we looked at is as a function of time, does this look like a low energy excess? And these events that I showed you in low energy here at red, we're looking at in orange here. Basically, this is in a given bin, we just count up how many we get as a function of time. What we find is that this rate falls off with time, just as you'd expect from the low energy excess. Well, excuse me. I guess I'm worried of
too much stress on this.
Yeah, exactly. No, I asked if anyone ever broke the screen, and I guess the answer is not yet. Anyway, so we can see that as a function of time, the number of events in this area of the background goes down. Just as a cross check, we can look at our saturated events that we think are coming from muons and high energy backgrounds and whatnot. What we find is that in this kind of teal and yellow curve, that these are statistically consistent with not varying with respect to time, which is exactly what we expect. So our detector isn't, somehow missing events at later times. At least this one cross-check appears to pan out.
The
ones associated with, it's the saturated events, so we think these are associated with like muons and gammas and high energy stuff. You really don't expect that. This is time in hours. This is much shorter ranges than some of the other plots I've shown you. But over the course of, say, a week, you don't expect the backgrounds to decay away significantly. But interesting stuff here is going on at kind of this middle energy range that you'll notice I didn't talk about earlier. So what we're seeing here is that stuff still kind of looks like it's this spectral shape of falling or of going up as energy falls, kind of just like the low energy excess. And if we look as a function of time, it also falls off with respect to time, again, just like the low energy excess does. And the question is, what the heck's going on here? Because it seems like the same behavior continues into the lower energy ranges that we're really interested in our low stress detector. So presumably, even if we make all of our detectors in this low stress configuration, we'll still have to contend with whatever the heck this is. So we know that it behaves in a very similar way to this thing that I think we've somewhat convincingly argued is related to stress, this mounting stress-related thing you're seeing in red versus blue. But since it's so similar between these two detectors, it seems at least unlikely that it's related to this form of stress that created such a drastic difference at lowest energy. So to this end, we started looking at stress elsewhere in our detector systems and came up with the hypothesis that metal films that we use as our photodetectors on our silicon, that this is the source of the stress associated with this low energy excess. And that indeed it's these metal films deforming that creates this low energy excess. So what we started to do is started trying to study the deformation of these aluminum films in our system. And we found that they could in fact deform. I can talk more about how we actually measure stuff like this if people are interested. But basically what we're doing is we're measuring the stress in an aluminum film put on top of a silicon thing. And we're measuring this as a function of temperature. So our experiment starts here and it kind of goes around in this loop. And what's happening is when we first start heating up our film, we'll get differential expansion between the aluminum and the silicon. And this will effectively put our film under stress. Now for a while, this proceeds totally linearly with a slope that makes sense from the relative mechanical constants and the thermal expansion and stuff. But at some point it flattens off. So even though you're putting in more deformation essentially through thermal expansion, the stress state of the system doesn't change. And in fact, if we then stop this and hold it at a temperature, we find is that over time, the stress actually falls. Then once we start cooling back down, we get this linear behavior that again makes sense. So what we interpreted this as is the film itself is deforming. Actually, for a while, we had the question of, you know, what exactly is happening here? We thought that maybe the film was just delaminating from the silicon somehow, that there's some kind of interface effect. So to try to figure this out, we tried films of different thicknesses where there should be different energies on this interface effectively. We found that it was independent of the film thickness. We found that, that really it seems like what's going on is the film itself, just the bulk aluminum is plastically deforming. Yep.
So like, if we go to the previous plot, if you like keep going, like then like you will go somewhere and
like this.
Yeah, and then like wait for a while. Like, does it go back to the original point?
Yes, yeah, so you're asking if we go to low temperatures rather than high temperatures, what happens?
No. I mean, like you go back to like 20 Celsius.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then like you wait for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Does it go back to zero?
We'd actually did a lot better than 20 Celsius. We did 77 Kelvin instead, and we found that yes, absolutely, that this process works the other way. So we can not only get deformation that happens when you cool stuff down a lot extra and watch the stress change, but actually the longer it's cold, the more it deforms. So thanks for that excellent transition.
Sorry, you cannot go down to where it was because it's plastic.
So you're asking, is there a reason why when you cool down it couldn't deform?
I mean, if you heat up and then you cool down, mm-hmm. you go back to your first point there in the plot. You cannot because the material is broken after you did that.
Exactly. So if really the reason why this plot stops here is we can heat up very quickly, but cooling down takes many hours and people want to use this machine who aren't us. So that's why the plot stops here. But if we were to keep measuring data points, what we'd find is that it would keep going this way. And if we were to end up at 20 Celsius, we'd end up at a much a different stress than we started, certainly. There's a limit to this, and that's kind of the mirror image of this. If there's some maximum compressive stress at which we yield, there's an equivalent maximum tensile stress at which we yield. And actually, in this plot, kind of looking at it, it looks like we might hit that limit on the positive end. Yeah, so as I was mentioning, we were able to not only see that the stuff deformed when it heated up, but kind of in a separate experiment show that when we cooled the stuff down, we could put so much stress in the film that it would again plastically deform. And as I mentioned, basically the longer it was cold, even over the course of, this is just, you know, overnight that we're looking, but we have data that shows over the course of even a week or two, that stuff seems to continue to deform as it continues to be cold. So after kind of stumbling into these results in the lab, we started looking at the literature more and found that, well, there isn't a heck of a lot of literature on aluminum films on silicon doing this. People have studied aluminum itself, pure aluminum crystals, and how they deform at various temperatures pretty extensively. And especially, fortunately for us, is a Soviet group that studied this deformation from 300 Kelvin all the way down to 1.4 Kelvin. And they found that even to the lowest temperatures that their experiment could access, that they are able to get the stuff deforming as a function of time is pretty exciting. Not only that, but in some updated version of their experiment, they're able to see that the deformation progresses not just as kind of like a smooth curve, but it was kind of a jumpy curve. So it would be flat for a while, and then it would jump up, and then it would be flat for a while, and then jump up. So basically what you're seeing is the deformation happens in individual little events as opposed to kind of a continuous flow. Or this is what they claim to have measured.
So
what they're doing is they've got an aluminum crystal, in this case it's at 3 Kelvin, and they're putting a force on it. They basically hang a weight from it. And they measure the length as a function of time. And they measure that this length changes in individual little jumps as opposed to continuously. A little part of me doubts this. This almost seems too good to be true because it's a pretty difficult measurement to do for a variety of reasons, but it's exciting enough I wanted to share it anyway. So before telling you about how these results translate into our theory of how the low energy excess works, I just want to tell you a little bit about deformation, which is the way that these metal films deform over time, and dislocations rather. So this is a kind of a simplified model of a crystal. It's just a cubic lattice. Real aluminum is what's called a face-centered cubic, an FCC lattice. So this isn't quite the right picture, but the same idea is transfer over. you can see what's happened is there's an additional plane of atoms that's basically been inserted here that ends at a point, or rather a line. And it's this line that's called the dislocation. So now, of course, this is like a perfectly straight line of this toy model, but there's no reason they can't kind of bend around a little bit on what's called the slip plane where this deformation takes place. Now, you can imagine if you move this dislocation kind of forward along the crystal, what actually happens if you keep moving it forward is the crystal deforms. So this is the mechanism by which metal films, specifically aluminum in our case, deforms. It's moving dislocations. And kind of in the converse of that, stress not only doesn't just create deformation, it actually moves these dislocations. Excuse me. So zooming in a little bit from this kind of macro picture of stress pushing on the dislocations, you can imagine that because these atoms come in individual rows, that the atoms kind of are an important part of this picture as well. And that moving this dislocation from one kind of plane of atoms to another, it isn't a completely smooth process. So people talk about a kind of quasi-sinusoidally varying potential associated with this called the Perillus potential. And you can imagine the potential of moving a dislocation down the crystal is kind of a tilted sinusoidal thing in the case of a stress field. Okay, so now given that just a little bit of background in dislocations, let me sketch out a theory in a couple parts of how the low energy axis works, which remember, important for dark matter. So our setup, which I've already told you a little bit about and applied other parts of, we've got our aluminum film. It's not a perfect crystal. It's made up of a whole bunch of different crystals in different orientations, just like this kind of sketch, or kind of comparable to the size of the film. But this contracts a lot more than the silicon when we cool down, so it puts this film under stress. Now, actually, the contraction due to this thermal contraction, which creates stress, it actually seems to be much larger than stresses we kind of get at room temperature. So this seems to be the important effect. And what you get is this thing deforms, creating dislocations that travel through your crystal. Now, by the time you've got to zero Kelvin, this thing hasn't relaxed perfectly. There's still some stress left in it. And the question is, what happens to that stress at zero Kelvin? So this is kind of a question of the dislocations that are moving around. How come they don't just move until everything's, you know, perfectly relaxed and in a zero stress state? And the reason is they get stuck. So I'm going to give you two examples of ways in which they might get stuck. And perhaps this list is incomplete because so far it's basically only me thinking about this. So the first way is your crystal isn't pure, isn't totally pure aluminum. It's got some impurities sitting inside of it. And these dislocation lines, basically they have an interaction potential with these impurities. So they'll kind of go along and eventually some of them will get stuck on impurities. If you sketch out the potential of the dislocation continuing to move, to continue to deform under stress, you'll get something like this. You'll get a local minimum associated with binding on the impurity, and you'll get a continued kind of linear thing. And you can see what I'm setting up for here. It's that idea that you can tunnel your dislocation through this small potential barrier and get kind of slow unpinning that way. The second way is through basically tunneling on this Perillus stress, this sinusoidally varying thing that's kind of shown in this more 2D picture over here. The only trouble with this is if you imagine advancing a dislocation just kind of one row of atoms, it turns out you don't get enough energy to be responsible for what we see. So if you're going to say the Perillus potential is what you're tunneling through, you need some kind of process that makes your dislocation behave kind of non-linearly once you move forward one. And a potential mechanism for this is what's called a Frank-Reed source. So basically, at a certain point, if you have a dislocation that's pinned between two points, it'll kind of grow into a circle as it's put under stress. But after a certain point, basically, after it starts to tunnel around the corners of these pinned dislocations, it becomes unstable, and it basically goes through an entire resolution. So it can go from this state to this state really quickly, resulting in a lot of deformation if you just advance the dislocation forward just a little bit at that point. And that's what we're proposing happens.
First of all, I don't understand why the impurity stops the dislocation stops because it can split in two. It's actually energetically favorable for the dislocation line to split into two.
So you're saying why doesn't it just kind of go like this and continue out, being stuck to that?
Yeah, the energy of a dislocation is just like Young modulus times dislocation length squared. So it's always energetically favorable to split a dislocation line in two.
I don't believe that's the case. I've read that there's an energy associated, like per unit length of the dislocation. Yeah. So it actually is energetically costly to make your dislocation get longer.
If to get it longer, yes, but to have a fixed size and just split that dislocation in two.
So, just to understand what you're proposing, the idea is it would stay bonded to this impurity.
Dislocation line, it has a fixed length. Say,
mm-hmm. Sure.
It's cheaper for you to separate that same dislocation into two 5-atom dislocations.
Okay.
And then they move.
But
I guess that first of all, I don't understand why do you need it to stop for your. Is it important that it stops?
Well, if you imagine that all this deformation happens all at once when you initially cool down, there's nothing to give you events, you know, tens or hundreds of days after you first cooled down your experiment.
Okay, so the hypothesis is that in time, you will first move a dislocation, then 10 seconds later, you will move another dislocation, and then so on and so on.
Exactly, yeah. I'm imagining a whole ensemble of these things, some of which are stuck, and then some of which unstick themselves then. I'm not sure I've convinced you, but hopefully we can chat more.
Well, I don't know. Is that the? Is the people measure? Do people measure this?
The motion of dislocations?
Yeah.
Actually, there is. So it's done in a pretty different regime. So what they do is they have silicon that are little tuning forks, and they oscillate the tuning forks, and they basically look at the amplitude and phase of the vibration when they have an aluminum film in it, and they use this to infer the dynamics of these dislocations moving around. So there's certainly evidence that they're sticking between these dislocations onto impurities, and then they get unstuck at some critical stress.
The other question that I had is that if you have a line,
mm-hmm.
Dislocation line, say 10 atoms long, how expensive energetically is to move it to the next row? What's the barrel's potential or something? Is it an electron volt per atom in the dislocation line?
So it depends on the stress. So you can imagine that as you continue to tilt this potential, basically that the barrier gets smaller and smaller as a function of stress. So I don't know the energy off the top of my head, but I do know the stress, which for aluminum is about 1 megapascal of stress. Just to give everyone a scale here, the stress you get from thermal contraction is like hundreds of megapascals. So there's definitely enough to make this process happen. I think it's order of fractions of a millielectron volt, but I'm.
It's fractions of millielectron volt. I think because 100 megapascals.
Yeah.
Megapascals. No, sorry. What's the typical Young models?
It's gigapascals, tens of gigapascals.
Young models times the atom size cubed, that's 1 electron volt. So then
yeah.
1 megapascal is very, very small. It's much less than.
Yeah, so millielectron volts. There we go. So in any case, we get these dislocations. They get stuck, and then I've just proposed a mechanism by which they can unstick and deform through a lot more of the crystal. The other critical thing I want to point out is you might have looked at these two pictures and said, great, there's two mechanisms. We can just calculate the tunneling rate, and then we'll know which one's the right one. Great. The issue here is not only can you have a lot of different say species of impurities or spacings between the impurities or sizes of Frank Reed sources, but actually you don't even know the stress you're talking about at all. The stress varies as a function of the resolve stress on the plane under which this deformation is happening. So it effectively depends on the random angle of the crystal in which this one deformation is happening. And what this will give you is rather than a single time constant, it'll give you tons and tons of different time constants. Presumably the ones that are fast time constants go first, and then the slower ones go later that have to tunnel through bigger barriers. In some ways, this is disappointing in terms of predicting something concrete, but in other ways, it more accurately represents what we see in the data. So in some ways, that's at least somewhat tantalizing result. So after we've unpinned this dislocation, after it's free to move about the crystal, what happens is it continues down the gradient created by stress, and it interacts with the Perillus potential. And as you see, I've drawn it here, it's sinusoidal. So as the dislocation kind of moves up this potential, it'll slow down. And then as it goes down the other side, it'll speed up. What you get is a dislocation that as it moves through the crystal, accelerates forwards and back. And this shaking dislocation, just like a shaking electron, radiates radiation, in this case, in the form of phonons. Now what seems to happen is these dislocations seem to accelerate to close to the speed of sound, and then you get radiation with frequency of order, the speed of the deformation, divided by the spacing, which kind of gives you a certain energy range for these phonons well into the athermal range. Now, the thing that happens to these phonons is quickly they down-convert towards lower energy stuff, and these down-converted ones turns into quasi-particles, which we then read out through our TESs. But along the way, some of the phonons can actually get out. And there's a theory called the acoustic mismatch model that predicts some of this stuff that I'm in the process of writing a Monte Carlo to try to understand a little bit better. So not only will this give you energy in the film in which this dislocation moving event is happening, but it'll actually put phonons into your substrate that you can pick up more globally. So at the end of this process, you need to stop your dislocation somehow. It doesn't just keep on going forever. So there's a number of things that can stop it. It turns out that they kind of stop it after all similar distances, so it maybe isn't super important to think about exactly which one's right. So you can have a grain boundary, you can have a dislocation in another plane, you can have an impurity, you can have something like that. And it turns out that if you kind of run through the numbers for what's a reasonable stress, it's totally reasonable, you'd get tens of megapascals once you cool down. You get about the energy scale that we see in our experiments. You get kind of hundreds of eV of energy released in this process. You also get that since the dislocation moves so quickly and it moves a relatively short distance, you know, probably hundreds of nanometers, something like that, this event happens very quickly with respect to the response for a detector. So it's that explains why these things look so much like particle events, if this is really what's going on. Okay, so getting a little bit closer back to the dark matter story, now the question is, what do we do about this? So I think that the first important step is to, I've just taken us on a somewhat speculative journey. So the first step is to validate this theory. And I think at the basic level, what this theory says is that it's aluminum that's responsible for the low energy excess. What we'd like to do is put extra aluminum on our detectors and see that we get a lot more low energy excess. And that's what we're doing. We're getting a mask fabricated now that will allow us to fabricate devices that are just kind of normal vanilla style dark matter detectors, and then ones with a heck of a lot of aluminum on them. What we hope to see is we get a lot more of these events and they decay just away just as expected and whatnot. So now that'll tell us where it's coming from, but it won't necessarily help us solve the problem. We already don't try to have a bunch of extra aluminum on our detectors. So what we hope to do is separate our phonon readout into two channels. You can imagine that when this event effectively happens in one, some of the energy goes to the phonons that go everywhere. We'll see the energy in both of these channels. But a lot of it, hopefully, is absorbed just locally. So what we hope to do is be able to discriminate between events where we see a lot of energy in one channel and not too much in the other, and ones where we see approximately equal splitting. And those are the ones happening in the substrate, and those are the dark matter ones. We're hoping we can make plots like this, where you get, you know, low energy excess events kind of preferentially partitioning into one, and then dark matter events here in the middle, the other. Okay, so before telling you about quantum computing, as I transition into the applications part of my talk, let me tell you a bit about optical heliscopes. I don't know if they're here, but I know there's a person at the Perimeter Institute. Hello, hi. Works on LamPost. So this one's for you. So in LamPost, of course, it's what's called an optical heliscope. So you've got a dielectric stack, and the idea is that much lighter dark matter, kind of EV-ish scale, converts into a photon, a visible light photon, in this dielectric stack. And then if you look for these photons, you can then constrain or perhaps discover dark matter. Now, the way these photons are currently looked for is with what's called an SNSPD, a superconducting nanowire single photon detector. Did I get that right? There we go. and the important thing to know about these is these things are basically single click detectors. They tell you if they go off or they tell you if they don't. They don't tell you anything about energy. And this is the technology that LamPost currently uses. So I'm a TES guy, that's my bread and butter, and I initially, when I heard about this concept, thought, oh, this sounds like a wonderful experiment. Why don't they use TESs? Unfortunately, TESs are a bit trickier of an experimental technology, and it turns out they don't currently provide any additional performance. Even if you play a lot of tricks with using energy resolution and pulse shape discrimination to try to reduce your dark count rate, which after all is what kind of sets the sensitivity of your heliscope search, they're really no better than the current SNSPDs. Now I
can go to lower energies.
With SNSPDs? Yes, that's also very helpful, which lets you search for lighter dark matter, of course. So what I'm proposing is that certainly at least some of the background these TESs see is from these stress backgrounds I've been telling you about. It seems like the TES chips that had the lowest dark rate are still glued down. So just by illuminating that glue, we should be able to get rid of a lot of events. The other thing is that While there's no big aluminum fins on these TES chips that you'd use to look for photons, they're still similar metals. So as part of the stack of materials that's used to both sense the photon, that's this tungsten, you have a mirror at the bottom to try to reflect some more back up into the tungsten, get more absorbed that way. And silver, just like aluminum, is an FCC metal where its properties at least suggest that you could get this metallic deformation that creates low-energy excess-like events. So there's kind of two sites where you might have the stress contributed to the background of these things that would hurt your TESs. If you're able to get rid of these, however, I think there's potential to greatly improve the performance of these TESs to make them potentially really a dream detector for these type of haloscope searches. Okay, so now we'll move completely away from dark matter and talk to you some about superconducting qubits, where it actually turns out there's a lot of surprising connections creeping up, kind of creeping in between dark matter direct detection and superconducting qubits. So the key figure of merit for any qubit, not just superconducting ones, is what's called the gate fidelity. So you might have seen, you know, such and such technology demonstrated with 99.3% resolution, and this is what they're talking about. Basically, to calculate this, what they do is they divide the gate time, how long it takes for them to do a certain, you know, operation between two qubits, by the coherence time of the qubit. And what this basically tells you is how likely it is for a qubit to decohere after having done a certain amount of gates, which tells you about basically how good your quantum computer is. And the coherence time, I don't know much about the gate time, but the coherence time is limited by two things. One is a process called quasi-particle poisoning. The other is by something called two-level systems. In quasi-particle poisoning, basically you somehow, through some mechanism that qubit people don't understand, energy is put into their superconductors that make up their qubits, and that this creates quasi-particles that leads to their qubits decohering. Two-level systems, as the name implies, are two closely spaced energies where you can have the system in one state or the other, with the state with this energy splitting comparable to the energy of your qubit, or as the ground and excited state of your qubit. And the idea here is that these things become entangled, and you lose energy and coherence when these things interact. Excuse me. What I'm about to tell you is that stress plays a role in both. So understanding this stuff isn't just a dark matter problem, it's a quantum computing problem as well. So before stress was really understood as a background, people were already interested in dark matter backgrounds, but traditional ones, in creating the quasi-particle poisoning that these qubits see. So people considered cosmic rays, as you can see being measured in this paper here on the left, as a source of decoherence, but they also measured just radioactive sources, putting radiation into qubits and then decaying away with time. And they found that, hey, look, the decoherence rate of the qubit also decays away with time, as a radioactive source does. But this is somewhat exciting. You know, our dark matter backgrounds are qubit backgrounds as well. But interestingly, this didn't explain kind of one of the key observations about quasi-particle poisoning, which is that the rates seem to die away with time in this weird way with time. Of course, this looks pretty similar to the low-energy excess, dying away with time, and that's what I'm proposing to you, that the low-energy excess of events we're seeing in dark matter detectors is the same thing as causing it here. Now, you might be surprised naively that the high-energy backgrounds aren't more important than the low-energy ones. Remember, we're talking about stuff at 100 eV, and muons, for example, might leave hundreds of keV or even more energy than that in a qubit material. And the reason for this is a little subtle, but essentially, in most qubits, the dynamics of these quasi-particles moving around are dominated by recombination. And it turns out that this process makes it way more important to have lots of little events. You end up with much higher density that way, as opposed to infrequent big events. So what we did is, based on the measurements we had in our low-stress detector, we simulated basically the high-stress detector I told you about way earlier in the talk. We simulated the quasi-particle density in a representative qubit and found that, well, you could have individual like muon-like events that deposited a lot of energy in your detector. Really what mattered for the average density was the stress backgrounds that would kind of drip in little energy quickly over time. So the question for qubits of what do you do about this is actually a lot easier than it is for dark matter direct detectors, because they can, in theory, separate their qubit really well from their substrate and not worry about these stress backgrounds. So you can play a lot of tricks. You can make your stuff out of different materials that doesn't microfracture in the same way. You don't have to glue it down necessarily. You can have your qubit floating. I think there's lots of interesting ideas here that I'm not quite enough of an expert in quantum computing to tell you about what's the most promising direction. Finally, I'll conclude by talking about two-level systems and how they might be related to stress. So one thing I kind of neglected to mention when I was just introducing these two-level systems is they actually interact with the stress state of the system in a kind of non-intuitive way. So what one experiment did is they put a qubit chip and they basically flexed it, and this is while they're operating it. What they found is that in kind of specific regions of frequency space where they operated their qubit, they found that they're two-level systems. And as they continued to strain or unstrain their crystal, what they found is the energy levels of these shifted with all these hyperbolae representing different kind of two-level systems interacting with their qubit. So this definitely implies a relationship with the stress of the system. And what I'm proposing in the course of kind of thinking about these Perlis potentials and whatnot is that that these two-level system states are the same thing as minima and Perlis potential. Now, to get this thing to work, you need to actually tunnel between these things and between these different states. And then the Perlis potential, that seems not to happen. However, there's what's called a secondary Perlis potential, which is associated with not kind of moving the dislocation forward one row of atoms, but once you have a little bit moved forward, kind of making that wider or narrower. And I think that has been shown through some simulations of copper. I think it's been convincingly shown that tunneling can really happen in important ways in the secondary potential. So you almost certainly have dislocation lines in aluminum. It's almost certainly have kinks in them, and they can appear to be able to tunnel laterally. And there's a very obvious coupling to stress here. So perhaps some of this big two-level system problem that qubits are seeing are related to stress as well. Okay, so just to summarize for superconducting qubits, I think there's a very strong case to be made that certainly stress in the way you mount these qubits, and probably additionally in their materials, can make quasi-particle poisoning that makes them decohere. And additionally, I think there's some interesting things to be thought about in terms of two-level systems being related to stress as well. Just to sum up, from more of a dark matter lens, we've shown that mount-related stress is really important for this low-energy excess, and I've hopefully given you at least one possible theory of how stress in detector materials can explain the remainder of this. I'll just conclude by saying that there's a lot of kind of exciting collaborations cropping up between dark matter experiments and superconducting qubit people, and I think that's really an exciting area to watch in the future. So, thank you. Any more global questions?
How can you simulate your quasi-particle poisoning? Because the qubits are presumably, the substrate is different, the layers are different.
Yeah. So this was based, so this kind of has two parts. We got the events from just what we measured in our high stress detector. We imagine that, you know, that's at least comparable to the events you'd get in a qubit that's glued down. So there's a fair amount of energy, there's a fair amount of information out there about the critical things to know are what fraction of the chip is covered by superconducting stuff. People publish stuff like this. There's how thick the superconductor is and what it's made of. And I'm not going to claim that this is a precise numerical exact calculation of what they'll see, but it certainly suggests that the important process here is the stress-related one rather than the radiation.
So you normalize the rate to what you measured, assume that the rate then was the same, mm-hmm. The qubit, normalizing by the volume of the metal in the qubit?
Actually by the silicon, the volume of the silicon in the qubit.
So this stress is coming from the... Where are the impurities in your hypothesis?
So in this picture, we're imagining that the things breaking, the things making these stress events, is between the glue and the crystal, because a lot of qubit groups have about a centimeter square of silicon that they just glue down. And what we're trying to show is, hey, look, if you do this, you're going to end up with a lot of phonon events that'll give you a lot of quasi-particle poisoning, and probably that's actually more important than the radiation-based backgrounds.
Normalizing to your low energy excess.
More or less. Exactly. That's kind of the background of concern here.
But and then that gives you an overall rate which is consistent with what they measured. That's your claim, or
so it's not the rate. The rate actually differs by close to an order of magnitude. I mean, it really depends on exactly which qubit you're looking at and whatnot. They're at least somewhat comparable in terms of absolute rate. The thing we're simulating is. And the thing that's again kind of similar within a single order of magnitude is the density of quasi-particles that are measured in these qubits and in these superconductors. And we get, they basically have, there's this thing called a reduced quasi-particle density that tells you about how frequently quasi-particles are as of, in terms of the number of Cooper pairs. And they measure that this is far larger than you'd get thermally. And we recreate a value that's consistent with what they measure within about an order of magnitude. So I'm not claiming we've gotten everything right, but I think it's at least shows we're in the ballpark here.
Because I thought that you were implying from what we spoke earlier that the low energy events from cracking of the glue were actually phonons that were moving from the glue to the silicon detector, and then to your aluminum fins that you measured, right? But the glue doesn't have like a centimeter cube silicon chunk.
So our detectors that we're measuring are a millimeter thick and a centimeter square, and qubits might be, you know, 300 microns thick in a centimeter square, but it's not a completely different form factor. It's at least roughly comparable. We don't really normalize to mass. It's kind of implicitly a normalization to area, but the areas are within a factor of a couple, pretty similar anyway. Yeah.
So is there any, like, would you expect the events to keep rising with energy, or would there be knowing energy, or would there be a peak, a characteristic energy?
Yeah, so Daniel and I were just talking about this, and I actually hadn't considered that before. So the model I have in my head is that you've got these dislocations that move in your aluminum, right? And there's going to be some distribution in not only the length of the dislocation that moves, but how far it moves. And what these results imply is that it seems to be that short dislocations moving a little bit is a lot more probable than big dislocations moving a lot. Now, after discussing with Daniel, I realized that there is kind of a natural scale here. It's that if you move a dislocation just forward one row of atoms, that's kind of a minimum scale. That's unfortunately a bit lower than what we can currently resolve. I think it's kind of hundreds or tens of milliEV rather than the kind of EV at which we're sensitive. But maybe in a few years we'd see it.
How do you confirm that it is? Because, I mean, you can play around with the aluminum.
Yeah.
That will tell you it's the aluminum. But then how do you confirm it's a...
Well, as we were talking about earlier, you can imagine trying to anneal these dislocations away. And basically what we're talking about is if you heat up your detector, there's some natural abundance of these dislocations. And if you heat up your stuff sufficiently, you know, to hundreds of degrees C, you can kind of get these things to anneal out. But perhaps if we, at 300 Kelvin, lower kind of the native distribution of this, we can lower the number of these that can tunnel when we're at low temperatures. I'm not aware of just pinning it a way to pin it precisely in dislocations. I know you can make more or less. You can learn something about their dynamics. Another way might be to vary the number of impurities in your thing, if that's the thing you're tunneling off of. That should give you there should be the same amount of energy left, but it should give you bigger, more infrequent events as opposed to smaller, more frequent ones with more impurities. I don't know. Thanks, everyone. I appreciated all the questions during the talk, and unless there are more questions.